Hi everyone, my name's Dev Raga, this is Dev Raga Personal Finance, and in this episode, we have a very special guest. Now, I've talked about personal insurance, particularly from a healthcare context, over many, many episodes, but in the last sort of 3 to 5 years, there's been a lot of changes when it comes to income protection, maybe even life, trauma, and TPD, particularly when it comes to getting it through super or outside of super, and some of the restrictions and some of the payouts are also, or the policies are all changing rapidly. And I think it's fair game to have an insurance expert. So I've got Phil Thompson from Sky Wealth, who's joining us today. So welcome, Phil.
Thanks for having me.
So Phil, we're going to talk about, it's going to be a deep dive. It's going to be about personal insurance, income protection, TPD life and trauma. And, you know, some of the questions can be very healthcare specific, but also go very broad into general professions as well, because I think it's important that the principles and concepts are extrapolated for the wider audience. So Phil, you ready to get started?
Yeah, let's go.
All right, let's get started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now, if you're new to the channel, remember the three main aims: education, empowerment, and entertainment. And the best way to get in touch with Dev is Facebook or Twitter. That's probably the most likely way you're going to get a response from me. I'm not a financial advisor nor insurance expert, so make sure you take anything you hear today from me back to your advisor. Now, a couple of things. Welcome, Phil. So tell us a little bit about yourself in terms of what you do, who you represent, what your business is.
Yeah, so I'm Phil Thompson from Sky Wealth. So it's my business and we are insurance-only financial advisors. So we give personal advice, so we'll make a recommendation on what insurance provider we think is most appropriate, and we help people set up those policies, and then we help ongoing management if we need to increase, decrease, as well as claims. So we just specialize in insurance only advice.
Okay, no worries. And just to be completely transparent, so Sky Wealth is not paying me to have them as a guest. And of course, I'm not paying them. I just can't afford to do that with this podcast. So just to be transparent, if you do want to engage Phil, it's between you and Phil. It's got nothing to do with Dev Raga. So, and I think it's important because I don't want people to think that this is a spruik or anything like that. Now, I want to get a couple of basics out of the way, right? So just to get things started, usually these sort of questions come at the end of the episode when listeners are a little bit tired and weary-eyed. Now, I see a lot of ads on TV for insurance, life, TPD, trauma, and income protection. Granted, you're an insurance advisor, so there's a little bit of conflict of interest, but should ever people consider these ads on TV and ring them up?
Yeah, I mean, my view is no, especially if they're talking about like no medicals, getting insurance through no medicals. They'll often have like catch clauses whereby they won't pay out a claim if there's a pre-existing medical condition. So they won't make the assessment up front. They'll take your premiums, but then at claim time, they'll say, hey, you got a pre-existing medical condition. The other thing to factor in, a lot of these ads, like there's plenty of companies that do it, but they generally only sell a handful of products. So, you know, you think about Medibank Private, they've got a life insurance policy, but they're not a life insurance company. They actually sell Zurich products. You know, the other ones, you know, there's plenty out there. RACV life insurance, they're actually selling a Noble Oak policy. So when you're going direct, it's generally, you know, you're not talking to the end insurance company. They're kind of like a badge product with those direct offerings.
Yeah, I do notice a lot of the insurance companies, like health insurance companies, I think Bupa now also have a life insurance arm and an income protection arm. They're really getting into this sort of personal insurance space. Now, just for listeners, in Australia, how many actual insurance companies are there? Not the retailers, not like Medibank Private, etc., but the underlying, the actual insurance company that provide these products?
Yeah, so I'll geek out a little bit. I know your audience may like to be, you know, talk a bit more technical, and you're a bit this way as well. But, you know, there are 34 companies in Australia who have a life insurance or friendly society license. Now, most of them don't actually offer life insurance. A lot of them are like investment products. They sell investment products like Generation Life. They've got to have a life insurance license. But they really just work in the investment space. But there's actually really like 8 or 9 life insurers who will offer cover. And again, they may sell or distribute through the Bupas or the Medibanks, but it's the end company is generally 8 or 9 life insurers in Australia.
So not much choice. I mean, not much choice in terms of the end insurance companies. Just out of interest, how does that compare to other countries like the United States? I assume they have a lot more variety, a lot more end insurer compared to what we have.
Yeah, they would. I mean, I'm not an expert in the US to know the actual numbers of insurance, but there'd be plenty more in those markets. And in fact, in Australia, we're shrinking. There's a lot of consolidation with insurance companies are consolidating. A lot of insurance companies you can still hold your policy, but they're not selling to new policyholders like AMP. Most people would have heard of the brand AMP. They used to be a massive insurer. They no longer sell insurance to new customers.
Right. And just to be clear, those insurance companies, 8 or 9 companies, presumably they also offer insurance through maybe MySuper, because that's another way that I can buy insurance. Is that right? Because if I'm with Hester, I'm not actually buying insurance from Hester. They're just selling an underlying product, you know, represented by the core company.
Exactly. And in that space, it's called group insurance. There's actually even less insurance companies who want to play in that group insurance space because, you know, you got to take on a $650 million contract, and insure, you know, 5 million members. So there's only really 3 or 4 insurers who play in that group insurance space.
Yeah, so we'll come back to insurance via super and outside of super. So with these sort of core insurers that you talk about, can I go to them? Can I go to them and say, hey, I want to buy insurance through you? And will they say, sorry, you can't deal with us. You have to go via insurance advisor?
Yeah, I mean, most of them do basically say, we won't help you. And again, I'll get a little bit technical, but in Australia, we've got some really funny laws around financial advice. Doing a personal finance podcast, I'm sure you've read up about, you know, what is personal advice, what isn't. Insurance companies don't want to play in that personal advice space. And so helping their policyholders increase or decrease their policies can be seen as giving personal advice, and they're not licensed to do that. And so they often will just have a flat ban. So there's many of those 9 companies I talked about don't go direct. And there's only actually 2 who will sell the same product you can get through a financial advisor direct to the consumer.
Right. Okay. So yeah, that's that technicality where, you know, the insurance companies are in the business of, you know, providing insurance. They're not in the business of providing advice. So using a conduit like an insurance advisor is essential. Now, you did mention you're a sort of insurance specialist. So does that mean that every financial advisor, because I notice your company name is Sky Wealth, are they also automatically an insurance advisor, or do you become a financial advisor, then you become an insurance advisor, or how does that work for the average person?
Yeah, it's a good question. Almost all advisors will have the authority to give insurance advice as well. And so, yeah, you don't kind of like do an extra specialization to do insurance. It's generally under the blanket of, you know, give the ability to give personal advice. You can do super investments insurance. So just like our business, we're licensed to provide advice on superannuation and investments, but we've made the choice not to do that. And a lot of financial advisors in the market, although they're licensed to provide insurance advice, they've made a business decision to no longer do that. It's a big issue in the advice landscape that very few advisors are actually giving insurance advice.
Right. Okay. So very few advisors are giving insurance advice. They're probably just concentrating on the other aspect, like actually providing financial advice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, doing wealth creation strategies, goals, and all of these other things that, you know, as a financial advisor, we can do. But yeah, they've chosen not to. I think there was a study recently, less than like 200 advisors are introducing more than 50% of all the business that are going to insurance companies.
Right. And is that because of compliance costs? And it's like you have to do a lot more, you know, compliance issues for insurance advisory. I'm just curious, why is that? I mean, or is it just more sort of profitable to provide financial advice?
Yeah, it's pretty unprofitable business being an insurance advice. Number one, the government made some changes a few years back in 2017, 2018, where they actually halved the commission rate, which I know we'll talk about how advisors get paid, but they halved the commission rate. And so most of the market over time have just decided, well, it's harder to get a policy, like to get a client insured, because there's higher declining of applications and it's more difficult to do the work. And we're getting paid heaps less and it's incredibly unprofitable. So we've decided to, well, most advisors have decided to kind of move out of that space.
Right. Okay. So how you get paid is interesting, because I think it's important in the interest of transparency, listeners understand, how do insurance advisors get paid?
Yeah, so there is a commission when you're setting up an insurance policy. So similar to like a mortgage broker, there's a commission. Now the commission rate is standardized. So that was one of the things that in 2018 it started to taper down, where it's capped. So the insurance companies can't pay any more than a certain cap for both upfront and ongoing. So advisors, we get paid to set up the policy and also on an ongoing basis every year to help manage the policy on behalf of the insurance companies.
Right. And those commissions and those rates that you get paid to set things up, it doesn't matter which insurance company the user goes to eventually, right? If you've got out of the 8 or 9, I'm assuming it's all just the same. Is that right?
Yeah, it's capped. I mean, if we recommend someone go to a more expensive insurance provider, then we'll technically get paid more. But, you know, if it's the same premium, insurer A or insurer B will get paid exactly the same.
Yeah, and that's important to know, because I think one of the myths out there is that if I go see an advisor, Dev, what's the guarantee that the advisor is not going to just, you know, recommend one particular insurer? Well, it doesn't matter, because that financial interest has been taken away. So you just get paid whatever you get paid, irrespective of who you go to, because that's really important. And
now, just touching on how we get paid, a lot of advisors in our business, we charge a fee as well to give the advice.
Yep.
So we try to, you know, make it minimal in terms of that initial fee, because the upfront commissions is just not sustainable. And so we charge a small fee. It's good for the clients because they get value upfront, whether they take out the policy or not. We can walk away knowing that we've been paid somewhat for the value that we've provided. But then if they do go, you know, clients do go ahead, then we get paid a commission for the policy.
Yep. And that's like going to see a doctor for a consult. So if I come to you for a consult, you diagnose my insurance needs and you provide a solution, provide a management plan. Very similar to patients going to see their doctors. You know, most doctors would privately bill or have some sort of gap fee when it comes to those sort of things. Now, the average rate of claims paid in Australia compared to the total claims made, my understanding is, correct me, Australia has a pretty high rate of claims payout compared to some of the other countries. Is that right?
Yeah. You can go to the MoneySmart website. I don't know if any of the listeners know MoneySmart. It's government website. The insurance regulator, APRA, actually requires insurers to pass back their claims rates, acceptance rates. And so they publish it. So you can see claims acceptance rates, and they give you, it's a really good tool, actually. You can see between super funds, financial advisors, and direct what the claims acceptance rate is. So I think I'd looked at it before for income protection. If you go direct to the insurer, it's the lowest claims acceptance rate at 88% for all claims is accepted for income protection. Through a financial advisor and through the super fund, it's a 95% and 97% claims acceptance rate. Everyone thinks insurance companies don't pay out claims. And just based on the stats, it's publicly listed via the MoneySmart website, there's a huge percentage of claims get paid out.
And that's important to hear for listeners who are not insured, because they're like, well, why am I going to get insurance? Because it's a scam anyway. Well, it turns out that 95% of claims are paid through an advisor, and even 88% of claims are paid out if it's through direct. So that's still a pretty good statistic. And I understand it's a much better statistic in Australia than it is in the United States. Now, you did mention that the viability of the industry from an insurance point of view, because insurance has become more expensive, particularly income protection, et cetera. And I think these sort of changes, they've introduced some changes, you know, from 2019, 2020, 2021, because they sort of felt, well, it's not going to be viable. Can you just briefly explain why they've sort of made these sort of changes on a broad perspective. And then we'll go specific to income protection a bit later in the episode.
Yeah, cool. I mean, there's actually quite a lot of changes that's happened in insurance. So one of them was protecting your super, which is great for the consumers, because what it was is super funds had to cancel insurance policies for any of their members for one of several reasons. If there wasn't money going into the account, they had to automatically cancel the policy, and they still do need to do it if there's no money going into the account within a 16-month timeframe, unless the member opts in to keep it. The other one is if the balance was below $6,000, the super fund needed to cancel it, or if a member was under age 25, they didn't automatically set up cover. So there was a lot of insurance policies that, you know, was kind of getting double charged. Like if you're a member with AusSuper and you had two super accounts, you could have had two insurance policies. And so you're getting kind of double charged, even though one of them was getting used. So that's one big change. Protecting your super meant that there was a lot of premiums that are no longer getting charged, which was good in lots of ways for members. You know, had some issues in other areas. The other thing was APRA, the regulator, came out and was really worried about the sustainability of the insurance market, and saying, hey, these policies are very generous in terms of their the ability to claim on these policies, and they're not priced appropriately. So what APRA did, especially for income protection, they made some limitations on all new income protection policies, whereby they, over a rolling kind of 2-year period, they made some pretty big substantial changes for all new policies.
Right. Okay. Now, before we sort of finish up this segment in terms of general questions and go into a deep dive, you briefly mentioned about insurance via super, and you mentioned the term pooled insurance or group insurance, I think it was, as opposed to what you normally would provide, which is individual customized insurance plans. Can you briefly explain the two? Because that is a common question that I get asked, because getting insurance via super is generally cheaper, but are there any catches?
Yeah, I mean, that saying it's generally cheaper through super is actually factually incorrect. Most people think it. We've been taught it for a very long time, but we do the math every day. We've got 1,800 clients, and every time we replace a policy in our business, I personally look at it and I personally check if it is cheaper through the super fund, because that's something we do as a part of our due diligence. 90%+ of the time, it's cheaper if we increase through the super fund versus taking out a retail policy or an individual policy, as you mentioned. So just touching on the cost point of view, that is a big misconception that it is cheaper. But coming back to what are the different types? Well, yeah, group insurance is if you're a part of an employer insurance plan, some employers will set it up, you're a part of that group. If you're a super fund, you're a part of that super fund group. And so the super fund will go and get an insurance policy and insure their members. And so that group, as long as you're with that group, you're with the super fund and you're with the employer, you're covered by that policy unless you choose to cancel it. As soon as you leave that group, you forego that insurance. So if you're moving super funds, it's really important to make sure you are setting up your own individual policy, or making sure, you know, when you join that new group, that new super fund, you're joining that group policy again.
Right. And I guess the question then is that if I change super funds and I have insurance between them, the definitions within that insurance, is it standardized? So, for example, I'm with HESTA. If I have insurance via HESTA and I change to, I don't know, Aware Insurance, does that mean my income protection policy that I have in HESTA, obviously I've lost that because I've changed insurance, I've changed super funds. But if I go and get income protection via Aware, is it going to be the same equivalent policy? Is it all standardized?
No. I mean, that's when we talk about like how many insurance companies there are. Well, there's like, you know, 9 insurance companies. Only 4 really play in that group insurance space, but there's hundreds of different contracts because, you know, Aware will go to their insurer, which is TAO, and they'll negotiate a contract, and they'll negotiate terms and conditions that are good for their members. You know, Aware have a big policy, a blue ribbon policy, so they insure police officers because they've got a insurance plan for police officers in Victoria. So they will I think it's New South Wales actually, but they'll make arrangements based on their members for that. HESTA will do something similar. So that each super fund will have very different terms and conditions. Now it's not wildly different, but it is different. Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. So I actually learned something new today, and that is the insurance policies are completely different potentially different if you change super funds. And also, I used to think super fund insurance was cheaper. So there you go. It may not be.
Especially HESTA.
Yeah, especially HESTA. So there you go. So look, I'm with HESTA in terms of my super. I'm not with HESTA in terms of my insurance, just to put it out there, just for transparency. But it's interesting that that's a little myth, what you were talking about, even, you know, people like me bought into that sort of myth. And lastly, before we finish up this segment, what is your advice? Has anyone come to you and said, Phil, I've been, you know, with you for ages about all these insurances. I'm actually self-insured now. Can you give us a little bit of an example about what sort of situation that someone can potentially be considered self-insured?
Yeah, no, good question. And actually, sorry, just go back on that pricing point. It actually used to be the case. Super funds used to be much cheaper. But there's so much changing with pricing that now it statistically is not the case. A lot of that kind of myth, well, back once upon a time, it was true and correct. Today, not so much. Coming to your question about when do people self-insure? Insurance is really just about protecting a loss of income. Personal insurance protection is really about protecting your family or yourself in the loss of income. Even life insurance. The way I think about life insurance is, you know, my wife's currently, you know, writing a book and she's not doing any paid work and she's looking after the kids. And so if I pass away, we need to protect my income because that's a significant loss. We want to protect the debt. We want to pay that off so my wife doesn't need to go out and work out how she replaces my income and pay the mortgage at the same time. So if an individual doesn't have a need for income and they're choosing to work from a lifestyle point of view, then maybe there's no need for insurance. And then it just comes down to just a values judgment. Do I want to keep progressing financially if something happened? Well, the only way to do that if you don't have an income to progress financially is to have insurance. Or am I willing to have a worse off financial future without this income and save money on those premiums? And if the answer is yes, then you can self-insure.
Sure, no worries. And look, I mean, a common question that I get is, oh, what if I just take the insurance money and invest it into whatever, you know, Bitcoin seems to be all the rage these days, then I'd be better off. Yeah, but what they don't calculate, in my humble opinion, is a risk. Because if you end up having a life event early in that process, then you're kind of stuffed. If you end up having a life event later on in that process, then you may have just gotten away with it.
I mean, the only way you're mathematically speaking, the only way you're better off is if you never claim. And many, many people have insurance without claiming. But if you ever need a claim, then the math will never, ever, ever check out, even if it's right at the later end. Mm. You know, I got a friend who just passed away this year, 43 years old, young kids. If he came to me and said, oh, I'll save this $2,500 a year in premiums and I'll invest it, he'd be completely stuffed. But again, each to their own. They can make a, you know, we're all adults. We can make informed decisions. But from a mathematical point of view, the only way you win is if you never claim.
Mm. So, and the other thing is, you know, just a notable thing about, you know, me being a doctor and this podcast being listened to majority healthcare workers, I'm always staggered by the number of healthcare workers who provide care to unwell patients, who provide care to really sick people, and who don't have insurance, but yet they drive around cars and they have a house and they never once hesitate to get that insurance for the car or the house. As soon as, you know, people buy a great car, the first thing they do is, prior to that, they've already got the insurance lined up. I find that weird. What do you think is the psychological reason for this, what I think is quite nonsensical, that we don't insure ourselves, but we insure a car?
I think it's actually default insurance within super has been this idea that everyone just always thought, so insurance inside super is cheaper and it's already there. I don't really need to worry about it because my super fund's got it sorted out. That's what most, I think that's the idea in this idea around, you know, not thinking about it. If that wasn't set up, there was no default cover, I think people would start to then consider it more seriously. These days, and again, you know, the insurance market has changed significantly. these days, the biggest super fund in Australia, the maximum level of life insurance cover that they will offer on a default level is $181,000. And you think about the average incomes, you know, now ticked over $100,000 for full-time workers. The average mortgage in Australia is over $600K. That default level of cover won't settle up. So yeah, I think that's from a psychological point of view. I think we're just a little bit of a she'll be right attitude in Australia. And my super's got it sorted. I don't need to think about it.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. So that's a pretty good start. What's going to be an in-depth assessment of the specific insurance topics, which is going to be income protection, life insurance, TPD and trauma. And if this episode gets a bit too long, we might have to go into part two. Because I think these questions get asked at the end of an episode usually and people don't really pay attention. So I thought I'd ask it first up. Then we'll go an in-depth into income protection. So we'll just take a quick break. And when we come back, I'm going to ask Phil some very specific income protection questions in addition to some generics. We'll be right back.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com. Click Get Help and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, we're back. We're with insurance specialist Phil Thompson from Sky Wealth. The first subtopic is income protection. Now, broadly speaking, what is income protection and when should people get it? Granted, you're an insurance advisor, so I'm assuming now.
Yeah, I mean, income protection, what it is it's an insurance policy and it replaces a percentage of your income. If you can't work for health reasons, and you're unable to work, it won't pay out for redundancy. It's just for, you know, health reasons, whether you're sick, unwell, you're injured, it'll pay a percentage of your income after your waiting period. So once you're injured, sick or ill, you need to wait a specific amount of time that's on your contract, you know, 30 days or 90 days. And if you're still not at work, then you'll get paid a percentage of your income or whatever your policy maximum benefit is, whichever's lower. And then it lasts until your benefit period ends. So the benefit period is the length of time you can be on claim for. So that can be 2 years, can be 5 years, or it can be age 65. Some of the older policies you can do till age 70, but they're pretty unlikely to happen. So when should you get it? My view is as soon as you rely on your income, that's when you should have income protection. Just as you said earlier, you know, as soon as you go and get a car, you get your, you know, nice new Audi, of course you're going to insure it. It's same with income protection. As soon as you have an income that you rely on, that's when you should be protecting that income.
Right, no worries. And I guess, and you did mention this just before the break about some of the changes of insurances. I think 2020 seems to be, I do remember 2020 seems to be the year when insurance policies kind of change, what you can get. I think one of the major changes was, you know, you can't or you couldn't get an agreed value policy, and I think you can't get it now. Is that still the case?
Yeah, so there was two changes. So in 2020 was agreed value. So the insurance contract income protection, in the past, you were able to just set it up. So if my income was $100,000 today, I could get an agreed value policy that says I will replace 75% of my income And then doesn't matter what my income is in 10 years' time when I need to claim on it, I'm guaranteed to get that agreed value amount. The other option was indemnity value, which is what we can only get today, which is I'll set it up based on my income today, but when I go and claim on this policy, does my income at time of claim support that benefit amount? So back in the day, you could have like a $20,000 per month policy as long as your income supported it when you set it up. Even if you're a gardener earning 50 grand a year and you're eligible for a claim, you can still get that 20 grand a month. And so that changed in 2020. 2021 was another set of changes. 18 months later was when that the level of income replacement dropped down from 75% down to 70%. There were some changes whereby any claims after 2 years, a lot of the policies are now based on what's called a any occupation definition. So for the first 2 years, you know, you're on claim, can you do your own job? And then after 2 years, well, can you do any job the insurer can reasonably expect you to do? And then, you know, the indemnity clause actually got limited. So it used to be, even though you had an indemnity policy, it was what's your best 12 months over 3 years? And now it's basically what's your last 12 months at claim time? And we'll base that claimable benefit on that. So a whole bunch of changes, pretty complex, but most advisors don't actually understand most of the changes.
You mentioned about occupation specific. So you said after 2 years, potentially they can reassess the claim and say you can go back to any work. Does that mean you can't get an occupation specific income protection policy now?
There is one company out there, and especially if you're in the medical field, you're eligible for these policies that does convert to an any occupation, but it's any occupation this insurance company will insure, and they insure very limited scope of occupations. So, but yeah, for most policies, you know, you buy off the shelf or go through a financial advisor to get. First 2 years, it's based on your occupation. And then after 2 years, it's based on any occupation.
How interesting, because a lot of doctors can't work in other specialties, right? I mean, I'm a GP rural generalist. I can't all of a sudden be working as a surgeon or whatever. But potentially, you know, they could say, if I got a new policy, they could say, well, you can be a telemarketer because you've just had a mild left-sided stroke and you can still move it a little bit. You can still talk. Is that what you mean? Because that's really staggering.
Yeah, kind of. It's any occupation based on your experience and training. And some insurance contracts talk about retraining as well. Can the insurance company, you know, reasonably expect you to do this? So for me, you know, my experience, I worked in a bakery when I was 14. I'm a financial advisor. I talk about death all day. I help people claiming on their insurance. It can be pretty stressful. If I need to claim on my income protection for mental health, for the first 2 years, they'll pay out if I can't be an advisor. And then after that, they could then say, well, can you do any occupation? You know, if you can't be an advisor, but can you actually do admin in an advisor's office? Well, yeah, you probably could because you're not directly dealing with the claims or directly, you know, setting up policies. Or if you can't do that, can you work in a bakery? So yeah, the big change, if you do have the older policies, it'd be super careful making any changes away from that product. Definitely speak to a specialist. If you do have an old policy, don't just buy a new policy based on price. Please don't do that.
And because when you upgrade, which a lot of healthcare workers might do because as their income goes up, they want to protect themselves, would they then be governed by the new changes or would they just be a variation?
Once you've got your policy, you can increase or decrease that contract and you're still under the old rules.
Now, you mentioned about, you know, income in the last 12 months. That's actually quite an advantage for doctors especially and some healthcare workers because a junior doctor is going to earn less than a senior doctor. So basically what you're saying is, with indemnity policy, it's probably advantageous if they do get sick as a surgeon, for example, and let's say their income, you know, surgeon's income, you know, anywhere between 600 to 2.5 million. And you mentioned 75%. So let's say the income's $1 million a year gross and their claim for income protection, is it 75% of the mil?
No. So that indemnity, so let me just touch on the indemnity side of the question. So the indemnity, you can only get paid a maximum of the contract value. So whatever you're insured for. So if I set it up at $10,000 per month when I set it up, but now I'm earning $1 million, but my income protection is still at $10,000 per month, I'll only get $10,000 per month. Doesn't matter how much I'm earning. They can only make it worse for you on that indemnity contract. So, you know, if I set it up and I'm earning $200,000, but at claim, I was actually earning $50,000 in the 12 month prior, then I'll be worse off because of it. You can't be better off because you're only paying for a contract worth, you know, whatever, $10,000 per month. So that's kind of coming back to the indemnity. The insurers can only use it against you. They can't magically pay you more because you're not paying for the contract for that higher sums insured. When it comes to levels of cover, this is where, again, definitely if you're a higher income earner, go and speak to specialists because they will know which insurers will offer a certain amount of covers. Most insurers on the market will only cap out the income protection benefit at $30,000 per month. That's the maximum. There are two insurers in the market today that will offer up to a maximum of $60,000, but you've got to be earning a pretty substantial amount because it's actually not even just a simple 70% of my income up to $30,000. They actually taper down. So for the first, you know, I'll give you an example of one insurer. For the first $300,000, they'll cover 70%. But then after $300,000, from $300,000 to $500,000 of income, they'll then cover 50% of your income. And then over that, they'll only cover 20% of your income up to that maximum benefit amount per month. So it's a little bit complex. I've probably lost most of the audience, but it's not just a straight mathematical formula of 70% of $1 million.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, that's relevant. And for listeners, you know, I got filled in specifically because I got very specific questions that I've had from listeners about, can you please ask Phil these questions? So bear with us as we go through this. Now, stepped versus level premiums, I'm assuming you can still get those?
Yeah, they're still available. The insurers are moving away from level premiums, so some insurers don't offer it anymore because the regulator kind of doesn't like the idea of the term level premiums. But what it is step premiums, let me just go back to, you know, cost of cover. So there's three ways that your premiums can increase if you're on step premiums and two ways if you're on level premiums. So the first two ways across both of stepped and level is if your level of cover increases with inflation. So within the policy every year, your level of cover, so the sums insured, can increase with inflation. So I've got $1 million of life insurance. Next year, it'll be $1,050,000. Next year, it'll be, you know, an increase again. If that happens, you'll get charged more premiums because your level of cover is going up. So that'll happen on stepped or level. The second way is based on insurance companies repricing the policy. Now, this is everyone gets annoyed at. The insurance company comes out and says, hey, we're not profitable enough. We need to increase your premiums by 10% or whatever the number is. Now, that can happen on stepped and level premiums. Now, the third way can only happen on stepped premiums, and that is just every year your premiums will go up just because you're getting older. On level premiums, your premiums won't go up just because you're getting older, but it can go up for those other two reasons.
Yeah, I can see why the regulators don't like the terminology level, because it's not really level, is it? Like it's
no, it's not at all. Yeah. If you've got those two options, like the insurer can reprice, number one, and if your level of cover is going up, well, you're going to get charged more. So, yeah, exactly. The regulators are really not keen on that term.
Slightly cheeky. Now, at what age does the premium just skyrocket? Like is it like once you reach 40, then everything else becomes crazy expensive? Like is it like an exponential curve in premium increases or?
Yeah, so I mean stepped premiums go on like an exponential curve because it's always age-based. And insurers, like that's kind of just a general rule. You know, whether you've got the policy or you're setting it up afresh, it'll kind of always go on an exponential level for stepped. Because it's age based, because of the likelihood of claiming increases. So for different policies as well. So this is basically a whole industry is actuaries, math geeks on an Excel spreadsheet to work out what's our claims rates. How do we make sure we're profitable? And let's price it accordingly. So like life insurance, if you're 50 or 55, the likelihood of passing away is statistically not that much more significant. So it'll still be higher, but the prices won't increase that much. For a policy like trauma, which I know we're going to touch on later, between 50 and 55, your likelihood of having cancer, heart attack, strokes, Parkinson's, MS is significantly more likely to happen. So therefore, the price differential between those two ages will be significantly higher. So it's very much dependent on the actual policy you have. And it's just all based on claim statistics and profitability of the insurance company.
All right. Question from a listener. You mentioned with indemnity, with income protection, it's the previous 12 months of income. What if you're on maternity leave and you've taken that year off? Because wouldn't that disproportionately affect women in a negative way?
Correct. And this is why, I mean, there was another APRA regulation that was meant to come in that got canned. Actually, APRA did a very smart thing and didn't bring it in. And that was actually to reprice everyone based on their occupation every 5 years. And they canned that because it was, you know, basically unworkable. Insurance companies had to do an incredible amount of work for no huge value add. And it would have really disproportionately impacted any parental leave because you would have had your policy cancelled on you if you're on parental leave at that time. So, but yes, indemnity contracts does disproportionately impact anyone who's on parental leave. Now, there are a lot of contracts these days will have like a, if you're a business owner and you have a bad year, they'll look at the last 2 years. And so they will go, what's the best 12 months over the last 2 years? As long as your income has dropped like more than 25%, then they'll look back at that slightly longer period. Same thing with like parental leave. If your income's dropped because of parental leave, then they've got the ability to look back that 24 months. And again, this is kind of assuming you've set up the policy through a financial advisor because super funds are very strict on it. And in fact, if you're not gainfully employed and you've got income protection through your super fund, you just won't get anything. Doesn't matter if you've worked for that 6 months and not worked for the last 6 months, you've got to be gainfully employed to be able to get any money from that super fund.
So current employment, that's what gainfully employed means, or?
Yeah, that's right. So if you're on parental leave, but you are still employed, then you'll still be eligible, even if you're not currently working. So gainful employment, it's really a superannuation legislation thing. I've geeked out so much on so many topics. I'll try not to geek out too much on that. But if you quit your job and you go on parental leave, or if you quit your job and you go traveling and you injure yourself, you're not eligible for an income protection policy through the super fund.
Yeah, yet another tax on women. So if you're a female who identifies as a female listening in on this, you know, that's pretty bad. Like that really does disproportionately affect women. What about insurance that I want to use my super money, but I don't want insurance via my super? I actually want to go to you and have an independent policy. Can I do that?
Yeah, so that's actually... I'll talk about it. So many benefits going through an advisor, and I fundamentally believe everyone should set up their policy through an advisor, whether we help you or not, I couldn't care less, but definitely go through an advisor. One of the biggest benefits is if your super is with HESTA, like you said yours with, and their insurance contract is with TAL, but TAL may not be the best insurance provider for you, an advisor can set up the policy so any insurance provider can insure you, but your HESTA money can pay a lot of the premiums if you choose to structure it that way. So technically what happens is the insurance provider sets up a kind of a shell super fund on your behalf. Now, because it's technically owned through the super fund, and the only reason they do that is just to get money rolled over from your HESTA into this insurance provider's quote unquote super fund, just to pay your premiums. Now they don't want to manage your money. They don't want to do any investment management. They just roll the small portion that's needed to pay those premiums. And so it means that, you know, if TAL's not the best one for you, but Zurich is or PPS is, you know, there's heaps of insurance providers, we can set it up so we can still get HESTA to pay it, but have the insurance contract through PPS.
What happens to my tax deduction? Because the income protection is tax deductible.
So if you hold the income protection through the super fund, you'll only get a 15% tax deduction for it because the tax rate within super is 15%. If you hold the policy personally, then you'll get the tax deduction based on your marginal tax rate. So again, if you're a high income earner, you'd want to look at holding the income protection outside of super because of the tax. It's so much more tax efficient. But if you're a low income earner and just from a household cash flow point of view, you want the super fund to pay for it. But some years you've got money to put into super to fund that premiums, then you can do like a salary sacrifice and then you'll be at the same net tax rate for those premiums. But again, you've got to make sure you're not capping out your concessional contributions caps, and there's a whole nother, you know, rabbit hole we can go down. But that's where for high income earners, you're already maxing out your concessional contributions because you're a high income earner. You'd want to consider holding it, your income protection outside of super.
I guess the advantage of using super money to pay your insurance outside of super is if you've got a cash flow problem, then, you know, it sort of solves that problem because, you know, insurance is very, very expensive. But like what you said, it comes out of your concessional contributions, right? So it's, you know, either way, you've got a bit of insurance erosion. And what I mean by that is you sort of erode your super over time because you're kind of using that money. So, yeah, I agree. My insurance policies are outside of superannuation. Last question, and I think we might finish up this as a part one. You're a client. What would you do? Insurance via superannuation, insurance outside of superannuation, or if you can't officially go one way or another, just let us know.
So, I mean, the other great thing about going through a financial advisor is you can make a choice today and then change it in the future. So I'll tell you exactly what I did personally. I set up my income protection, life insurance and disability inside of super. And then what I did as my income grew, I actually then moved my income protection outside of super. So what we did is what's called a cancel and replace. So I didn't need to go through underwriting to set this up. The insurance company said, well, it's the same. We're taking on the same risk. We'll just cancel that policy, set up a new one. So now you're paying it outside of super. Now, if you set up the policy only through your super fund or you go direct to the insurer, you basically don't have those options because direct, you always have to pay through cash flow. Super, you only have the option to pay through cash flow. But yeah, through a financial advisor, you can do that cancel and replace. So personally, I've got life insurance and TBD inside of super, income protection and trauma insurance outside of super.
Right, that's interesting. Yeah, thanks very much. And that's very good of transparency. I think it's important to hear that from an insurance advisor that you do have some super related insurances in terms of you do use your super money to pay the insurance premiums. So that's a lot on income protection. I think the take home message for me, the biggest learning points is super is not always cheaper, and also that you can't just randomly earn $5 million and expect 70% of that to be claimed. Because I think a lot of high-income earners would be like, oh, that's okay. Its indemnity is great because it works in my favour. As my income goes up, I get paid more. Well, that's actually not true. So that's very, very useful. So thank you very much for that. We'll finish up and we'll call this part one. And Phil's got some spare time, so he's going to hang around. We're going to talk about in part two life insurance, TPD and trauma and some special questions from guests. So thank you very much, Phil, for this is the end of part one. Now, if you want to leave a 5-star review on whatever podcasting platforms you may want to use, or maybe leave it on all of the platforms, that's even better. Please leave a positive review because it really helps us spread the message. We'll be back in part two of an interview with an insurance expert, Phil Thompson from Sky Wealth, and we'll talk about life, TPD and trauma. And until next time, please make sure you stay safe.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Symo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.